Dit is De Laatste Utopie. Plakkerige dansvloeren, zwetende lichamen. Het nachtleven is nu slechts een vage herinnering uit een ver verleden van voor de pandemie. Ik, Persis Beckering, schreef een roman over dit onderwerp, Excess. Waaraan ik begon zonder te weten dat het nostalgisch zou worden. In deze podcast praat ik met Nederlandse en internationale gasten over het fenomeen dat al bijna 30 jaar massa's mensen op pompende beats bij elkaar brengt. En ik wil begrijpen, waarom bestaat rave eigenlijk? En is het nog altijd die utopie die het ooit was? In deze aflevering spreek ik met DeForest Brown Jr. Hij maakt muziek als speaker music en hij schrijft. Momenteel werkt hij aan zijn eerste boek, A Sampling of Black Counterculture, over de geschiedenis van techno. Hij is ook ambassadeur van de campagne Make Techno Black Again. Hij woont in New York, dus we spreken elkaar op Zoom. En het gesprek is in het Engels. To ask you first, have you actually missed the club this year?
No, not at all, actually. And I'm pretty disturbed if anyone is missing the club while upwards of 2 million people are dying of the coronavirus, like after this amount of time. I mean, to be frank, things are pretty hellish in America right now. And it's ironic because, I mean, a lot of the things happening now, the various police killings, the trial of former officer Derek Chauvin's murder of George Floyd, like the near 200 tornadoes in my hometown of Birmingham, which is like really affected by environmental racism and voter suppression and things like that. Like, these are all the things that inspired techno in the first place. So it would be particularly insulting to me if I were to hear someone complaining about not being able to go, you know, club to stolen black music.
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel that speaking of the history of techno music, it's like you said, there's so much that this music relates to these subjects, like to what's happening now, to Black Lives Matter, climate emergency and climate apartheid. And that's, I think what your writing does really well is to connect so many different things, looking through or just starting with music, with techno music in particular. You go all the way, in your book, A Sampling of Black Counterculture, you go all the way back to 1619, if I'm correct. Can you explain me, why does a book about the history of techno start all the way there?
Yeah, I mean, my main interest in techno has everything to do with the idea of a 19-year-old black kid, Juan Atkins, becoming friends with a 29, 30-year-old black man who named Rick Davis, who was a Vietnam veteran that would protect, he was like enlisted to protect like COINTELPRO, like PSYOP labs in the Vietnam War. So distributing American propaganda and brainwashing techniques, if you will, to the native like Vietnam people. Their meeting and coming together in the band Cybertron is a really particularly like historic kind of meeting where, I mean, people have to understand when Juan Atkins was using like an 808 drum machine, that stuff wasn't on the market yet. Like, he was buying the stuff from like pawn shops after Motown left Detroit and like left behind a bunch of like really expensive gear that was not supposed to be accessible to children. And then for him to like, you know, become friends with a Vietnam veteran through like a audio engineering course, and for them to start making music about the future and about the American military industrial complex, kind of opened up a ripple of potentially like investigative events. One thing in particular actually is that Rick Davis, in I believe a 2014 interview with like at Red Bull Music Academy, there's only a few interviews with him because he's kind of often forgotten. But Rick Davis goes on about how he came back from the Vietnam War, which was the first war in American history that black and white soldiers fought together, without like segregated barracks and units. And he talked about how like he was surrounded by white supremacists, like in the US Army, who were spreading anti-Black propaganda to the Vietnamese, along with like handing them Coca-Cola and like music and stuff. But he points out that when he came home, the American counterculture, like the hippie movement, was in full swing, taking acid that was distributed to them by the government. And he points out that they were defending people like Charles Manson. Like Charles Manson, the like cult leader murderer, was amongst this American counterculture that the European counterculture, like 40, 50 years later, it like is mirroring. Like they had a serial murderer and cult leader amongst them that was intending to start a race war. And so he points that guy out. Like Rick Davis goes straight up, like, Charles Manson is the key to what is happening in America. And so anyway, I scroll all the way back to 1619 as a way of explaining why African-Americans, or why an African would be in America in the first place, because there's a kind of a one-to-one answer with the transatlantic slave trade. Though Black people have been re-indigenized into America, we are not naturally indigenous here. So when people talk about Black people and like African-Americans, there has to be this this understanding that they're talking about something really absurd and horrific regardless. Like it's a reoccurring thing in American culture and history, is this sort of like gross absurdity of just the circumstances of having built up a society on a massive continent in which white European colonizers murdered millions of natives and then like overturned the soil to the point that like that natural disasters like tornadoes, dust storms, and earthquakes are happening all over the place in various like regions. And within all of this, in the middle, in 1979, 1980, you have one Atkins and Rick Davis sitting down together, just discussing what the hell a city is. Just like, what is the future? They don't know. Because if you look historically, they would be the first and maybe second generation of Black people to have even existed in the northern part of the Americas after the Civil War, because there was a great migration in the 1920s because of the industrializing northern states like Michigan, and also the Underground Railroad that people like, that's, you know, slaves like Harriet Tubman would use to help Black slaves down in the South escape. They would go to Detroit. And so, yeah, when, again, talking about techno, talking about Detroit, it's all entangled in this distribution, this history of chattel assembly line, settler colonialism, industrial capital. There's so many different adjectives and like labels that we can throw at this to basically say that talking about Black people in America should be a horrific and disturbing thing for someone not from here. And really white people here to talk about and to understand as they're saying it. And so the book tries to make that very, the very cybernetic reality of Black people and the invention of techno very explicit.
Is there also a direct musical line that goes all the way back? I mean, besides from, of course, the fact that like the music is produced by Black people, but like, are there musical vestiges?
Yeah. And it's funny that there were sort of immediate lines that I already knew just like intuitively from, you know, being quote unquote Black. But as I investigated further, there's all sorts of like direct lines that were kind of frightening in terms of like just how one-to-one they were. For example, so I talked about Motown leaving Detroit in 1972, which they left because of race riots that erupted in 1967, in which over half the city was literally burned to the ground and abandoned. And this is just over a police killing. And also it was over labor, like, I think the suppression of unions as well, and like housing. So the same shit that's happening right now, like literally right now. because I think in Minnesota right now they're going on day five of literal warfare with their police force. But with Motown, there was a band signed to Motown pretty early on called The Temptations, and I found out they kind of like innovated this sort of doo-wop kind of vocal quartet style of singing that I found out actually originated in my hometown and in the neighborhood that where my grandmother lives. And I had a lot of thoughts about that, that like an early pop music that was kind of based only in the vocals, that would be like four or five guys in a circle just kind of, you know, singing these like church hymns together, like, you know, snapping and kind of and the thing that Berry Gordy was trying to do was take blues music, jazz music, and this kind of vocal music and place it inside of a studio complex. And I like to actually, people don't often think of it this way, but I like to put or place Berry Gordy from Motown next to Stockhausen and talk about how the two of them were electronic musicians creating nationalist musics at the same time. I mean, Stockhausen was trying to make music for the German youth, for the future, for this German futurist movement that kind of didn't actually exist. If you look at things like historically, and Kraftwerk obviously takes that vision and tries to really formalize that a decade later. But anyway, with Motown, it's Berry Gordy was, and along with like the producer Norman Whitman and a series of other engineers, were trying to create the perfect soul music that could be marketed and sold to everyone under the banner of the sound of young America. And also coinciding with the civil rights movement and the hippie movement. And it's funny because like after a decade of like 110 Billboard hit records of this like black universal popular music, the city erupts in riots and Berry Gordy ends up, you know, leaving town to go to LA, leaving about 5,000 people like unemployed, like the city's up in flames. And, you know, and then Marvin Gaye's What's Going On comes out, Stevie Wonder's Inner Visions comes out, and like Motown has this like, yeah, just this like economic leap into the, and cultural leap into the future in the 70s that Detroit was completely left out of. And I often like to point out to people that if Motown had stayed, Juan Atkins would probably be on Motown and we would know him as a sort of jazz fusion, like electronic jazz performer and not as dance music proper. It would probably resemble something like Herbie Hancock more, which Derek May and Kevin Saunderson were actually supposed to produce a Herbie Hancock record in the 90s, but yeah, it didn't work out. So the link wasn't actually put into place. But I could even go a step further and talk about Sun Ra, which I recently found out he's actually from my neighborhood and is buried in the same cemetery as my great grandfather. And yeah, we actually, my family owns the house of the composer and band leader that taught Sun Ra how to play trumpet, actually. And his ideas, like Sun Ra's ideas of, you know, using sound and using poetics and the poetics of sound to, you know, reshape your mind and to sort of move from geocentric, like me-centered worlds into heliocentric, we-centered worlds is, I mean, the entire point of techno, as kind of explicated further by Mad Mike from Underground Resistance. And so, yeah, there's a, I could go all day on these, like, you know, genetic and sonological kind of pathways that have formed over the last 400 years over here. But yeah, there's a long line and a very particular reason why when it, like techno and house were exported over to Europe in 1986 and 1988 respectively, that people heard it and immediately were like, oh my God, I want to move. I'm going to dance and start a revolution. That wasn't by accident. That was misfired and misdirected sonic technology being, you know, I won't even use the word appropriated because I think that's a bit much. I'll say that it was shared and not necessarily understood and not necessarily given back into that context. So yeah, there's a reason why, you know, Europe breaks out into this massive dance that I always joke is like reminiscent of the dancing plague of 1518 when like, I forgot which European countries had like the bread with like this fungus in it and they like broke out dancing for like a full year.
Yeah.
was it France in Strasbourg, the Choreomania?
Really interesting. Yeah, that's something I actually found throughout while reading the book as well, is like these moments of dancing plagues that would break out throughout the West. Because actually, in the 1800s, there was a movement from a Native American group called the Blackfoot Confederacy, in which they would do a thing called a ghost dance. And there's a techno track from The Martian called Ghost Dancer that actually kind of evokes this, but it's a war dance in which the natives would kind of do this like, yeah, cathartic dance that would travel between tribes, and the entire sort of nation of like Native Americans were all doing this like spiritual dance. And it reminded me, and there was like, you know, repetitive drums and like this kind of footwork happening. And yeah, I often think about, yeah, the dance plague of 1518 and the ghost dance, but also the sort of dances that would take place in Congo Square in Louisiana amongst like Black enslaved and free people. No, there's something about dance and music and this like, I'll put it in quotations, like rave culture that is universal, but maybe not used for the same endpoint, same consequences, results.
One of the things that you're writing have made me see and understand better is how knowing the history of electronic dance music, or techno in particular, which you explore into great detail and with much rigor, it goes much further than merely acknowledging that techno is a Black creation and that white club music is indebted to it. I mean, it's also about understanding what it is that people are actually dancing to and what the music is expressing and what it's carrying, the ideas, the concepts, the soul, the history, the blood, I think. I mean, like where European ravers, I guess, or like, let's say like white ravers mostly understand house and techno as celebrating unity and freedom. What you also show is how it's related to and rooted in like Black bodies laboring in a cotton field along the assembly line. And that's how that's a very different activity and type of movement than just like, let's embrace everyone and celebrate our unity.
Yeah, it's really interesting. One of the things I like to focus on also with techno is this like sense of technology as like neutral and technology as, just got some water for my partner. She's like, drink some water. She actually spent a lot of time, 5 years in Berlin, and definitely did like the Berghain raving thing and moved to New York kind of to get away from that after a while. It was just like, you know, it's a bit much. And so we have a lot of conversations about, you know, what the hell the last 30 years of DJ history, you know, I put that in strong quotation marks. I hate that phrase, DJ history. But
why?
Because it's so ridiculous. It actually just is ridiculous. And I'll explore this within the question that you just asked. I mean, when I hear the phrase like Kraftwerk invented techno, or that like Stockhausen or whoever like technological person invented techno, there's a sort of white supremacist assertion that technology is neutral when only used by those that have been, that are from and within the technocratic imperialist like new world that has been like developed, like industrialized world. And what techno is to Black people is a feeling, just like jazz is a feeling, just like you know, funk is a feeling, blues is a feeling. Techno is literally Black men looking at specifically this like weird Japanese technology, like, you know, a Roland like 808, and being like, oh, cool, whatever, man. And like, just like playing it. Whereas, I mean, you think about someone like Stockhausen, we can go to the GRM, movement, we can go to the Italian futurists, we can, you know, do this whole thing where Europeans clearly developed technology and clearly like, you know, built microchips and like figured out coding through like a sort of Heideggerian, like, you know, poetic, like codic logic. But all of that's fine, but it doesn't account for, the thing is, I love that stuff. I love the history of technology and I love the history of, you know, industrialist technological development, but it doesn't account for the literal soul of a 19-year-old Black kid touching this drum machine, which ironically was built by a black guy from Alabama. I forgot the name of the guy from Roland that, like the CEO or the founder, he's known to be the guy that invented MIDI, but that's actually not true. There's a guy named Don Lewis from Tuskegee, Alabama, which is where my aunt went to college, and also where the Tuskegee experiments took place, in which the U.S. government tested out MIDI, or for about a decade, they tested and infected many black men with syphilis and left them there to die and track the results of how long the syphilis would last in the body. And yeah, those men were never given a cure. So that's a really interesting fact to think about in the middle of COVID-19 right now, when vaccination rates for, you know, anyway, that guy, basically, he played some of the first like technology, musical technology that would come into the black community, which was the Hammond church organ. And he played that during civil rights rallies with Martin Luther King. And he eventually got a Linn drum machine and attached it to his Hammond organ using the skills that he learned as a nuclear scientist in the US military. And he called it like wave bending, or like a circuit bending is what he called it, where he would take the wires and kind of hotwire this primitive musical technology together and created the format for what would eventually become Juan Atkins' techno, sort of, or I would say unknowingly would become Juan Atkins' techno, because Juan used the Korg MS-10 keyboard and like a Roland 808. Well, Don Lewis used a Hammond organ and a Linn drum machine. And actually that's how he ended up meeting the guy from Roland who made that drum machine, and they like, Don Lewis was hired to work on what would be the 808 drum machine, in which he sat down and really like plugged in the sounds, like figured out all the different little drum sounds that would go in, the cymbal sounds, and he even like showed them his circuit bending technique to show them how to connect instruments with a synchronized clock, which at that point had never been done before. But I know that the same guy from Roland and a guy named Dave Smith in like 1985, a few blocks down from me, actually presented the paper on MIDI at, I forgot the name of that conference, but there's a sort of audio technology conference that would happen on Broadway in New York, where they presented the paper saying that they discovered MIDI, when in fact that was actually done almost 10 years prior by Don Lewis under contract with Roland. So anyway, I tell that story to say that like, I love the history of technology and understand that it's a very Eurocentric invention that Americans like really took to some monstrous end when you consider the internet, television, radio, and all the other sort of the assembly line and all the other sort of upgrades that would come with in the late 19th and early 20th century. But again, the actual, how should I put it? The actual, if we want to speak in Marxist terms, right? The actual like labor that black people have done is alienated such that when we touch that gear, it's never going to be the same. And even when I play now, I play all of my drum beats with my fingers. Like it's all very live, like tapping and kind of, it's just not the same.
Something I'm also interested in is what you mentioned a few times, the word future or futurity. In the music of techno pioneers such as Juan Atkins, was there some expression already, some kind of like utopian expression there, or like some future imagination? You mentioned Sun Ra and Afrofuturism. How was this expressed in the early techno music?
You know, this is actually a really funny thing. So though my father and my mom would go to sort of raves in Detroit and Chicago, and my mom's from New York and would like listen to freestyle music and early hip hop music, like they presented techno, like I heard Juan Atkins as a kid, but it was mixed in with like George Clinton and like other like types of funk music, like all of, like hip hop and techno and house were all just like one blended thing of Black people touching technology down here, or down where I was from in Alabama. And so I didn't really, when it comes to like techno and stuff, I didn't really think much about it. But when I was in college at around the age 19, I found this book, The Third Wave from Alvin Toffler, which, you know, it's all about societies or developed societies being run by technical experts and using human labor as a sort of resource to fuel this technical society. So, you know, what we have right now, where we're using Zoom right now to communicate, and, you know, and but there's some guy like pressing a button over and over again in an office to make sure that the Zoom like signals keeps working. That guy is the techno producer in this, if you will. But yeah, when the thing I found interesting about Toffler is that like, or about, basically while reading Toffler, I came across the word technocracy, looked it up, which is a society run by technical experts, and immediately fell upon Juan Atkins and techno. And was like, whoa, there's this other Black guy that like read this book, except like 30 years prior or 40 years prior in a high school class called Future Studies. And I think it's quite interesting because, I mean, Detroit is the seventh city to be constructed and funded in the U.S., primarily through the gold rush. There's so much going on here. So in the 1800s, during a lot of like slave rebellions that were happening, the state of Michigan that Detroit's in, published news stories basically telling people to go over to California and grab some gold and bring it back to Michigan, and they could like build up a utopian city with it. So it was a scam. And Detroit is literally a scam city that a bunch of investors like threw their money in technology into. So you have Henry Ford, who took the plantation model from the American South, which produced cotton, the first like material traded along the global trade lines, picked by Black people. And he was like, that assembly line model of cotton picking works really well if you use it to assemble cars. And so you have the Fordist model of business management that would kind of emerge out of that. And a bunch of people from the South in the 1920s would move up to Detroit to then work on these assembly lines and to apply these skills again. And this would obviously result in several race riots over the next few years, with the worst being in 1943 and then the 1967 one I kind of mentioned. Anyway, what Ford was trying to do was design a city for his cars. So, I mean, American cities aren't designed to be like Europe. You can't just go walking around and then like you need a car, and you have to drive between these like closed up castle ecological zones called cities and drive. Like, for example, I would go to Chicago every summer to live with my grandfather, who I love dearly. From Birmingham, and he would drive 8 hours from one city down to the other and then drive 8 hours back. And like, that's the thing that people have to understand when they're talking about the difference between like house, techno, and hip hop and things like that, is that these people are driving hours between each other. Like, you can't just jump on a train and like it's not EasyJet. Like, it's not where you're in France, you're like, oh, I'm going to go to Berlin and party for a weekend on like a $25 flight or whatever. It's, I'm going to pack up all my shit and like drive for 10 hours from Chicago or Detroit to like New York and back again. And it's a journey. And you're driving straight wilderness for half that time. So anyway, when Juan was reading this book in 1980, 10 years after Detroit had completely collapsed because of this like Ponzi scheme, unsustainable technological urban planning, I don't think he was really thinking about it, again, as a 19-year-old, but what he had was the blueprints of a settler colonial industrial society like right in front of him. And then he started dreaming of techno cities and metroplexes and all of these sort of, fantastic futures that he literally like didn't even get to experience. And I think it's really, I would love to talk to him about that one day, about like the fact that he was dreaming of a future inside of the ruins of a future. Because I always tell people that Detroit, the way Detroit collapsed, which is in race riots and high inflation and lean production models being squeezed to the point where workers were getting like laid off and automated, that's exactly how the whole of America will collapse. And we can see that now with Tesla. We can see that now with Amazon, which the Amazon unionization efforts are actually, that was happening in my neighborhood. So if you saw all those news clips, those are my family. We see it now with the police killings and the riots happening across the country right now. And it's Detroit had, like, the collapse of Detroit is expanding across this whole continent. And Juan Atkins has had the key this whole time. And it, particularly his partner, Rick Davis, had an even higher understanding of this from being in the military, from understanding the way that Ford would propagate both, you know, the need to have a car to feel successful and to be in the idea of mobility as freedom, while he would also use his newspapers to spread anti-Semitic, you know, rhetoric. So it's a thing where Rick Davis was like really tapped into the way that Americans use public relations to make itself seem like a good, free and democratic society when it's actually committing the worst Holocaust known to man. Because, you know, it lasted 400 years and it's still going. So yeah, it's, there was definitely utopian thinking that I would say maybe was of a child's mind. And then about 10 years later, you have someone like Matt Mike who comes in and Drexia, where they start expanding these sonic fictions. And Matt Mike starts thinking about, you know, music and these black vinyl discs as like a sort of tactical weapon to send out audio viruses, to reprogram minds and to, to wake people up from the matrix, if you will. Whereas also Drexia was trying to take the transatlantic slave trade and really use the underwater civilization of Drexia, this sort of like adaptation of black African people that were thrown overboard from ships and were forced to adapt to the water. I mean, obviously they died, but in as both a coping mechanism and as a speculative model, having them survive and adapt and build civilizations of their own and their own nation within the no man's land of the transatlantic ocean or the Atlantic Ocean is a good way to mirror and understand what happened to black people on land in America, which, I mean, the majority of black people in America are in North America, are in the deep South where I'm from, in the Black Belt, where all the cotton was picked, where all the like plantation slaves were. And like, that's, the Civil War was fought along those lines. Like the South was its own Confederate nation that was separate from the European industrial funded Union states of the North. And so when they fought, they were trying to fight over black bodies as technology and black bodies as like, I mean, particularly it was over the census for the presidency, because the Southern aristocracy that formed under slave labor would still be empowered now and would actually, it is still empowered. That's the Republican Party. But basically Abraham Lincoln was trying to disable our technology of the South. They were trying to disable black people by freeing them and saying, okay, your $42 billion investment is gone, which at the time black people were worth $42 billion in the South. They went bankrupt and still are bankrupt from that, which is why I'm telling you about all the infrastructural problems that happened in Texas, Mississippi, and so on and so forth. But yeah, Drexia tries to really, there's actually a map that comes in his record, The Quest, that came out in 97 that you can't really find anymore. But if you go to like Discogs, you can like go through all the liner notes and there's a map where it shows you, it shows you like the transatlantic slave trade. It shows black people migrating up north. It shows in 1988 techno spreading across the world. And then there's a speculative journey home that happens, which I don't know. We'll see if that journey home happens, but I'll say that his last seven albums, which he wrote in 2002 in the Deep South, James Stinson of Drexia moved from Michigan down to a city outside of Atlanta, so about maybe 1.5 hours away from where I grew up. He goes down there and starts writing these Storm albums, which are the last two Drexia albums, and there's one under called Other People Place that was put out on Warp, and there's like seven records that basically evoke these storms that are potentially engulfing my home right now. Like I said, there are nearly 200 tornadoes that are destroying communities down where I'm from. And I think that Stinson was kind of like Alvin Toffler was understanding of the ecological load that the American continent was under, or that was like the ecological load of America is being overly exerted by the technologies and by the industry infrastructures that these colonizers put here. And the earth is literally screaming and producing tornadoes and coronaviruses and all sorts of like climate change. And the white people here are not listening to the earth. They're not listening to the, like, I can look outside and see that the sky, like, it's not okay. And actually that's the soul that that's always being pointed to, is the fact that in the agricultural revolution that happened in America, separately from the one that happened in Europe and Asia and, you know, elsewhere, Black people were the ones that did the labor, that stuck their hands in the dirt and really got to know the earth in a similar but not same way as the Native American population. And that is what goes into techno, is this ecological understanding of how much these technologies have extracted from the earth. So that futurism, it's a very complicated thing that now I, in 2021, am kind of trying to like look back on. Like, I very much believe in like Beefo Berardi and Mark Fisher's concept of like the future being canceled. And in fact, read that around the same time that I read Toffler and saw Toffler being like, you know, in a fourth wave, there's probably going to be a giant like global consciousness era and then a collapse. Well, I moved to New York in 2013 to see the global consciousness era, which no one thought it was really strange that we were all, you know, talking about global club scenes and using Facebook and Twitter and all these things to communicate with each other for the first time, which is why we're having this conversation. Like practically speaking, you know, it's because of this global consciousness, and then there's a collapse that happens. And so Juan Atkins, when he read The Third Wave, was kind of like, when he was like 19, was like, you know, I want to know what the fourth wave is like. I want to know what it means to combine the mind, body, soul, and like cyberspace. And what I saw when I read it in 2010 or so, after the 2008 crash, I was like, you know, I'm going to give America about 10 years to see where this goes, to see how much we can inflate the economy, since, you know, they're not going to hold the auto industry accountable, which Obama actually bailed out the auto industry, which would have collapsed all of America, but just like it did Detroit. And yeah, I mean, America's been running on credit for, yeah, the last like 12 years, or I guess 13 now. And so, yeah, there's a great collapse that is both happening now with coronavirus and is pending to happen very soon. And that's kind of where I come in with this Afrofuturist vision. It's going, look, I'm here at the end of the future, and you guys fucked up. And that's.
Yeah, I mean, I relate a lot to what you're saying. Like, for me, this end of the future feeling has also been very important to my own work and my book. And I wanted to ask you about that as well. But I'm actually interested. You have your own musical or sonic project, as Speaker Music, and in your last album or record, the Black Nationalist Sonic Weaponry, in the liner notes, I also read about. You describe these things as how this project aims towards a future that isn't indebted, and I'm quoting out, to the fictive and failing socioeconomic progress imagined within the frames of white American techno-utopianism. I mean, these words are beautiful. And I was wondering, how do you see the function of your music as future building? Like, are you actually imagining a future that your music is reaching for?
It's funny you would ask this, because though I recorded that album in a weekend, and it was a really quick pressing, like I literally like was writing the tracks as I was making them, like live. It was a very intense thing. After the murder of George Floyd, I just lost it. Like I just lost it and put everything I had into that record. And it's, but the name came a few months earlier, actually. It's funny. There's a bonus track on Bloodthirst and Jungle Fever that was written when I was in Rotterdam the year prior, for a conference, a regenerative feedback. It was at like Worm Wormwood. But yeah, I sort of did my first like recordings of what would become that last track then. And then the name actually came to me while I was in Amsterdam the next year for Sonic Axe Festival. So I don't know, it's something in something about the Netherlands that just kind of like, it's strangely tied into this project. Maybe it's like the having traveled like the trade lines or something, but yeah, really interesting. But yeah, the name Black National Sonic Weaponry popped into my head actually on my flight back from Rotterdam to New York. And I was reading James Boggs's, he's a like a political activist and I'll call him like a theorist of cybernetics and automation, like a really early one, who is actually from Alabama and moved to Detroit in one of the great migrations in the 1920s and 30s to work on the assembly lines and to organize in like labor, labor unions and fighting the company Chrysler that he was for, but also Henry Ford and all these other people. But I was reading his book, The American Revolution, Pages from a Negro Worker's Notebook. Just kind of getting ideas, and a lot of the titles on Black National Sonic Weaponry are actually quotes straight from the book that I kind of like ripped out of context and like sort of in a Dadaist fashion kind of like worked into place with my own like kind of titles or words. And so you should be able to read the track titles like straight down as like one breath and one poem. But yeah, it's funny because like the Netherlands is such a strangely hyper-capitalist place in that it's much more efficient in the way that it taxes the people than America. For example, like in Amsterdam, I had to use like the bathroom at a train station. So I had to like, I guess you like pay to leave the station and then you turn a corner and pay to go into the bathroom and then you like do it all over again. And it's like, you know, that's fucked up, but also at the same time, it makes like logical sense that, okay, I am like maneuvering between spaces and maneuvering between needs. So let me like tokenize, not the government so much, but the infrastructure. Like that makes good walking around sense, as my grandmother would say. So it frightened me, but it was also very practical. And I like that about it. But I think I got my head kind of, got the juices flowing in my head as I was reading, you know, James Boggs talking about trying to unionize workers, specifically, you know, interracial workers, like Black and white people who were working together for the first time ever since the slave trade had ended. And he talked about how Ford would do something like give everyone like refrigerators and, or like give people enough money to go buy a refrigerator, new technology to make their, you know, to help the food last longer, I guess. And he was like, that's all they needed. That's all the workers needed to drop a union. And actually the Amazon unionization efforts were actually voted down by workers because, and I was talking to my mom about it. And she's like, well, unions cost too much and there's not enough infrastructure in our country. There's not like car insurance costs too much. Like mortgages cost too much. Gas is too much. Like it's all too much to do this communal kind of tokenization system that, I mean, I hear so many brilliant thinkers like Matt Dryhurst like talking about, he's a friend, but it's like, I hear about these decentralized like tokenization systems and like it's, things are too extractive in America for that to work. We are not a communist country. Like America is a capitalist, industrial, imperialist, settler, colonial, like warship. Cause that's the other thing. The function of America is to go blow up other countries that appear to rival it. Right now they're focusing on China because you know, for the last 30 years, China has like actually tried to build infrastructure for its people and have actually tried to, you know, to actually, you know, build itself up, and America just can't stand to see it. And it's, anyway, while on this flight, I was sitting and thinking about the invention of the airplane, the invention that's an American psychotic invention with Wilbur and Orville, like White, or Wright, and the Wright brothers would basically put on like flying wings or like mechanical wings and try to like fly off cliffs and shit like that. Like, I was thinking about this insane reality that Europeans so readily took and like optimized and made pretty like, you know, hefty and useful, but it's, yeah, I mean, again, flying in a plane is psychotic and it's, and I was thinking about how James Boggs, who's now dead, failed. his book, his understanding of automated labor, his understanding that if America was allowed to automate this labor and to produce a global consciousness through its imperialist technology, like, I mean, he focuses a lot on like the nuclear bomb and how America is a, there's a before and after the nuclear bomb, which killed 275,000 people respectively between Nagasaki and Hiroshima. And he's like, you know, the amount of loss, the amount of literal loss of life that was like taken from this technological advancement, like whatever society exists beyond that point is a new kind of people. And no, he seemed very frightened of the possibilities of liberal democracy spreading after a bomb like this, while the plantation structure is being mounted inside of factories that have been, again, clearly optimized from the Fordist model up to whatever the hell it is Jeff Bezos is doing with Amazon. Like he has like the workers playing video games, like competitive video games against each other on the work floor. Like I don't, while they have to like poop and pee in bags and stuff, like this is, I don't know what level of capitalism that is. But yeah, this, all of this was like flowing through my head and went into the music practice of using an iPad and like hot wiring it into Ableton and like doing this very haptic, tactile, ghost in the machine kind of music.
I'm interested in what you're saying now about your own musical project and going back to Juan Atkins, what you said about him imagining a future among the ruins of a future that was once promised but was always a hoax anyways, maybe especially, or maybe just for certain white men it was not, but so if you're imagining a future among the ruins, what does that future look like?
You know, I thought I knew before the other day when Dante Wright was murdered by the police. And I thought I knew when I was reading James Boggs before the coronavirus, you know, spread across America. And I watched America blame China for something that they did not take the effort to actually mitigate themselves. And then I watched the 8 minutes and 47 seconds that is now 9 minutes and 26 seconds that George Floyd was murdered. I mean, the thing is, like, I've seen every angle of George Floyd's murder many, 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 many times. And I did it on purpose because I wanted to see it, and I wanted to feel it, and I wanted to inherit that pain, and I wanted to take it with me when I leave this country. Because I'm now an ex-American and will no longer participate in this Nazi, like, white supremacist bullshit. Like, and I will say that, like, here on the podcast, like, America is a Nazi white supremacist country. If you need proof of this, look into the Nazi KKK marches that happened in the 1940s, just before Jews came to America for asylum, just before the Israeli state was propped up by the Republican Party, and now being propped up again by the Republican Party through Mike Pompeo, who is also trying to spur war with China through Vietnam. But, you know, I thought I knew what a future looked like, but after sitting and living in a country that has allowed, I mean, last I checked, there were 543,000 people dead from coronavirus, and no one can care. No one cares here. I see everyone partying. I see everyone, you know, talking about how they're excited they got their vaccinations that won't even be useful in the next 6 months. Like, but again, because of this lean production, it's not because I'm an anti-vaxxer that I'm saying this. It's literally looking at the Fordist model and how this has continued on into like getting a product out as soon as possible without like, and using the population as a means of, I mean, cars are an experiment on the people to see how people can handle high velocity machines. Paul Virilio wrote many books about this, particularly Negative Horizon, and also his book on the motor. And the vaccines are another example of this. But after watching Americans and Europeans basically lock down, open back up, and like pour out into the streets, lock down again, and open back up and pour out into the streets. You know, I started to look at the West and go, you know, I see how a bunch of people could huddle together and, you know, kidnap slaves or Black West Africans in the middle of the night, pack them up, you know, 400 people at a time, like sardines in a ship, and ship them across the sea, and then put them on labor camps where they would work 20 hours days and like eat literal slop for food and like be put in like blinders and told not to speak their own language. And no, I see how it's possible, because the West is showing me right now. It's showing me that they can't give even the slightest of a fuck that, you know, 2 million people are dead. Like, not even the slightest iota of a fuck. And, you know, I've heard so much about, you know, how bad Hitler was. I've heard so much about the Holocaust from Europeans particularly. And it's like, show me that you care about lives by figuring out this virus and figuring out another way to live your lives besides, you know, trying to get back to normal. The Americans, I don't expect better for them, because I know their history, and Europeans should learn it to know that Americans are gruesome, evil people. Ask the natives, ask the 20 million natives that have been murdered to build all of this up. But yeah, I don't necessarily subscribe to Afro-pessimism, which Frank Wilkerson actually is from Mississippi, which is like a few hours away from where I grew up. And I don't go there because Mississippi's fucked up. Like the Black only capital of Jackson, Mississippi, like they have no water, they have no infrastructure right now. And it's because of, like, again, environmental racism and like structural, like actual structural racism, where they're not sending water into the city. Like, the government is not sending water to the city and like not repairing the pipelines. It just, yeah. So yeah, it's a thing where I want to think about futures practically. And I'll say here that my father, who's a business economics professor at a historically Black-owned and run college in Alabama, has started investing in patenting and distributing like a solar panel technology, and using this to power Native reservations, Black community, like poor, low-income Black communities, historically Black-owned colleges and like schools. And he's been talking to me a lot about infrastructure, about like, he's not necessarily an environmentalist, but he's smart enough and lost enough money in the oil, you know, market to realize that we have to stop sucking resources from the planet. And that's the kind of future he's thinking about. Like, he's trying to invest in solar and invest in other types of alternative resources to keep what he and I kind of consider to be a Black nation, with like a Black Palestine within the Israeli state, if you will, of America, the whites, like, and to put these numbers together, because I know that people will be like, oh, like kind of offended by me saying something like that. There are 12 million or about 14 million Black people in America. And there are 330 million people total in America. 300 million of those people are white. So you can do the math and see what that what the situation looks like from a Black perspective. And my dad is doing, you know, his damnedest to power the stuff. My mom, who's a social worker, is spending her time and has spent the last 30 years doing social work and you know, mental emotional care for runaway Black kids, for homeless Black kids, for, you know, like, she would say that she's raised upwards of hundreds of kids, like, both independently on her own, like financing people, like making sure that, you know, single mothers can like eat. My dad has like rented out properties to people to like make sure that, again, single mothers and people in low income situations can have a home. Like, that's the kind of future I'm looking towards. And that's the kind of future that James Boggs is looking towards. And particularly, actually, I'll show you this book. Just, I know that people in the podcast can't see it, but I've been reading this book called The Black Reconstruction in America, 1860 to 1880, that from W.E.B. Du Bois, which picks up right after the Civil War. And this book is how my home of Birmingham, Alabama, and the adjacent city of Atlanta, Georgia, Jackson, Mississippi, like these places in the Black Belt, these Black nations emerged post-Civil War out of independent Black capitalism, unfortunately, and Black culture. And that's kind of what I'm looking towards, is I don't give two flying fucks what, you know, Elon Musk has to say. He can go to Mars for all I care. I hope he goes. I hope he leaves.
Yeah. You know, I don't,
yeah, it's just get out of here. Like, you know, and we'll re-indigenize ourselves into the earth and figure this out ourselves. Like, you know, white Americans can go off into their VR lands and sell their bullshit Beanie Baby NFTs. They can do all of this like fanciful meta. What did the Book of Oz twins call it? The metaverse. They can have it. They can go off into their fantastic, like post-Catholic religious, like utopian dreams. I'm going to be down here with my family trying to build real infrastructure that is not based off of fictive cult-like behavior.
I actually just want to end here because I wanted to resonate. Thanks so much, DeForest, for this conversation. I mean, you've shared so much in 1 hour. I'm really amazed. Deze podcast wordt gemaakt door mij, Persis Bekkering, in samenwerking met Luc de Groen. We worden ondersteund door het Nederlands Letterenfonds. We zijn vandaag te gast in het culturele noodhospitaal van Felix Meritis, het cultuurhuis voor kunst, wetenschap, technologie en ondernemerschap. Felix Meritis deelt haar faciliteiten kosteloos met andere culturele organisaties om in deze coronatijden te kunnen blijven creëren. Dus dankjewel, Felix Meritis. Ook bedankt aan Lucky Fons de Derde voor de geweldige intro tune en Martin Krog voor het logo. Mijn roman Excess is verschenen bij Prometheus en die koop je natuurlijk het liefst bij de lokale boekhandel.